I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hello everyone, and welcome to Pixels. This is a show where we cover the gaming news for the past couple of weeks, and we talk about PCs, consoles, mobile, all of that good stuff, so you don't have to go and read every single blog out there to know what's happening in the wonderful world of gaming. My name is Patrick Beja, and today I'm welcoming to the show Michael Bell, also known as Bellular. How do you even pronounce this?
You know, it's funny. I barely ever say it, so it's always a surprise to see which way people go.
Well, I'm really glad to have you on. As we were sort of geeking out before we started recording, I've been watching your channel on YouTube for almost a year now. And it's mainly World of Warcraft stuff, but you also do a bunch of other games. You're avid gamer, of course. Yeah. And so we were talking about this. I think it might be interesting to the listeners. I discovered your channel, as I was saying, when I was completely geeking out on Legion, the new World of Warcraft expansion, well, new from last year. And it was about, I don't know, June, July, something like that. And you sunk like an uncountable amount of hours into that beta and basically produced more video than I could watch. And I didn't understand how you had time to do all of this. Like, is this your life?
It's half of it. The other one is game development, which is a strange one. Legion was, that was a fun time. I made myself almost unavoidable with all those class reviews.
Yeah.
But certainly, yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, I discovered the channel, and I talked about it on The Instance, which is a World of Warcraft specific podcast I do. And
I missed that episode.
Wow. Oh, you did? So how did you find out? Because you then at some point tweeted at me and say, "Hey, you know, I like your stuff from the old days of The Instance," and I was like, "Oh my god, he knows who I am!" And I was like, completely.
Probably had a mutual geek out back in the day when it was
the mod of the week.
Patrick's mod of the week.
Right.
Way back.
It's, you know, it's really funny how these relationships develop on the internet, because basically, so this is the first time we're talking to one another. And it's since I've been watching you on the channel for a few months now, and you've heard my voice a few times on a few shows. It's like, oh hey, how are you doing? Yeah, cool. And what have you been playing? It's like we almost know each other already, and we've never spoken, right?
All of the introductions, we don't need to do them. We're kind of already caught up.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's crazy.
It's really fun. I'm really happy that I can get you on the show. And as you mentioned, you're also a game developer. Can you tell us? I know it's not, you know, not a lot of it is public, but can you tell us a little bit about what you do there?
Yeah. So it's a bit of a funny situation. Basically, I'm 22, so pretty much fresh out of university and back in second
Holy
year.
Holy crap! Wait a second, 22. That means when I started doing the things on The Instance, you were what, 11 or 10?
Something. This is like a town crier situation, isn't it?
Yeah, basically. Oh my, that maybe we shouldn't have dove into this. That's funny. So Okay, before we get back to the conversation about your what you're doing in game development, I want to ask you, were you playing World of Warcraft back then as well, or did you discover it later and you fall into it then?
Yeah, so I discovered it. This is, I always get really confused because it was on New Year's Eve, so I don't remember like which year I actually started. I think it was 2006. Yeah, it was New Year's Eve 2006.
All right, so it was, yeah, back in the day, yeah, maybe not the very beginning, but you were like 3 when the game launched.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
It was back in that time where, like, YouTube wasn't a thing, so you know, if you wanted more content about the game, it was either a blog or a podcast, because that stage YouTube was, like, it was cats and it's sort of its early stage.
Yeah. The post stamped size videos and cats on skateboards. Yeah. Skateboards, yeah. So how did you like? So you started playing at that point, and when did you start like thinking I want to create content about the thing?
That was a strange one because it was actually Mists of Pandaria when I first started. Like I kind of liked the idea of doing YouTube stuff in the past, but Mists came around. It was like after first year in university, there was all the start of your first year is a crazy time that involves a lot of sore heads, but then it all sort of smooths over and ends and you're kind of left there just thinking, what am I going to do? So a friend of mine reintroduced me back to the game because Mists of Pandaria came out right when I hit uni, which pretty much ended up meeting no wow, but I remember getting in and I'm sure you remember back the MOP days with all the dailies. I was sure, doing like my full share and yeah, I just sort of thought, I'm spending this much time anyway, I should probably try to make something of it.
And so you just decided, all right, I'm just going to launch a YouTube channel about this and started doing it?
Kind of. It was that mixed in with one day I had this idea that I wanted to become a brilliant StarCraft 2 player. Suffice to say, that didn't turn out. And I thought, you know what, I'll stream StarCraft every, you know, once a day or whatever, and that'll keep me practicing like a good professional player, and I don't think I ever made it out of platinum. But I soon was like, yeah, I'll just do a WoW video. Sort of threw it up, and yeah, started with YouTube.
Cool. All right. So basically, the blissful days of university where we think we have no time at all, but actually we kind of do, and there's time to waste to do stuff. That's a pretty nice part of our lives, I guess. So now you're in game development. What about that?
Yeah, so that's it's a bit of a strange one. We're really only, I think, getting in our stride at the minute. But it's one of those things where you try something out, you spend a year kind of like failing and learning at the same time. So we actually ended up abandoning a project that had a little bit of funding going into it, which didn't feel good, but we're now sort of going into our future stuff with a lot more wherewithal. So I guess what we're doing, we're developing in Unity. Our sort of future main project is, I won't give the title because we're not sold on it, but it involves kaiju and mechs and stuff like that.
So it's like PC development or consoles or
PC. We're going for sort of a strategy game, and one of our more unique twists we really want to go for is like sort of unique characters and stuff like that. My co-director in the business writes plays, continually scares me, but we're sort of using him for all the dialogue stuff.
So you're 22 and you're basically, you said co-director, so you're heading the game, the company, the development.
Pretty much. It's nice. One of those, like, there's only 4 or 5 of us, so it's we all have to wear
a small team,
quite
but still
a few hats.
All right, cool. I know you're also... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
That's pretty much the long and short of it. I will have announcements in the near future, hopefully.
All right. I know you also have a really interesting WoW mod that you're working on, which has a lot of narrative elements to it, which intrigue me a lot. And so you studied game dev, like you're a programmer, right, at university?
Yeah, or? It was one of those times when, you know, the university, because of course, you know, universities, they really care about their bottom line quite a bit. So they advertise a course as game development. You think, oh, wow, you know, I'm going to go do some game development. And you're really doing a sort of a soft computer science degree. Which is why me and my friend ended up, we left before our sort of master's pathway finished, just to head right into actual game development. So from that, it's more of a programming background. But thankfully, he also is a theater guy. I don't think you find many programmers and theater people, but that's we're a little bit more rounded out because of that, I think.
All right. Well, there you go. That's the message for today. Kids, don't stay in school. You don't need it.
do you want Silicon Valley?
I don't, but I imagine that's what they say.
Well, for the viewers who've watched that, it's a little like a sort of Peter Gregory situation.
All right. Well, that will mean a lot to them. All right. Well, this turned into a mini interview. I didn't plan it like that, but that was cool. Hopefully it will help listeners be informed about how we're... how we're going to be talking about the different games. We're going to be talking about Mass Effect Andromeda. That's actually the main reason I have you here, because you've been playing it quite a bit with the early access thing, and apparently there's stuff to say there. We have a little bit of of a conversation about the sales for the Switch. Yes, we're going to be talking about the Switch every single episode until the end of time, it feels like. A little bit of Zelda as well, sales for Horizon, PlayStation 4 stuff happening, and I guess we can get started with Mass Effect Andromeda. So the reviews have come out, and we might talk about this a little bit later. The game seems to be getting, there was over the past few days a bunch of memes developing on Twitter and elsewhere about the animations for the game, which honestly sort of tainted the perception for many people. It sort of got me to take a step back and go like, oh, wait a second, is this actually how it is? Maybe I shouldn't dive headfirst into it. Also, I have a bunch of other things to play, but this sort of got eclipsed now by the actual release of the game. And let's put it like this. The reviews seems to indicate that the game is far from perfect, but it will give people the Mass Effectness that they are looking for, even if it's not to the level of the previous Mass Effect games. And I have a bunch of other more precise questions, but I'm wondering if you feel with the, 10 hours you've put into the game, what are your feelings on that front?
Yeah, so I played it for 16 hours at this stage, and it's a very, very bizarre game. And a lot of people talk about sort of BioWare 2.0 and sort of the Dragon Age Inquisition and onwards era, and it definitely feels like a game that's had many hands working on it, and I'm pretty sure the team size increased quite a lot as well. It's interesting that it does take, at least on the face of it and what I've experienced so far, quite a lot of nods from the structure of Dragon Age Inquisition, which, you know, that was the one thing that I was personally pretty worried about, because I play World of Warcraft, as we covered, and those sort of MMO styled side quests, they weren't really what I was looking for in the Mass Effect universe. So you've got that whole game structure, I think, thing sort of operating in one corner, and what that does to the game's pacing. On the opposite one, we've still got the Mass Effect style missions that I think most of us sort of know and love, where we've got our characters and, you know, the interactions between all your companions, and, you know, they're good, high quality, AAA sort of feeling things. The game is often at odds between those two sides. It's trying to tell you this, you know, right now, I think maybe a little bit generic, but definitely engaging and covering some interesting ground sort of story. But then it's sometimes bogged down in the filler and the stuff like that. We do, of course, see there's a lot of really brilliant things in this game. The combat, I think most of the reviews universally have loved the combat.
Yeah, everyone's saying that basically the action gameplay parts of the game are significantly improved.
Yeah, man, it feels amazing. You feel like a force of nature. In fairness, I'm playing as a Vanguard, so they're kind of... they're biotic, which is basically the Force in the Mass Effect universe. They try to Technobabble a solution as to why it works, but it's the Force.
Right.
But with that, you know, you're charging into combat, you're lifting people, you're throwing them, you're just chucking a guy off a cliff, and it all that is really brilliant. And then, of course, yeah, as you covered, there's all the memes. They're hard to escape.
All the what, sorry?
All the memes. All right, the, right. You know, the facial animations. And
I guess that's my first question. How is it actually that bad as we've seen in the memes and the GIFs? And, well, I guess there are some moments that are that bad, or otherwise they wouldn't have filmed them. But does it impact your enjoyment of the game, or are they few and far between enough that, you know, you don't worry about them so much?
So the really bizarre thing is, so of course, the way this game worked, and this is another really interesting discussion, is the review embargo that kind of expanded as time went on, and then the EA Origin Access trial thing, which was like the first 8 hours. In that first 8 hours, I saw far more problems, far much less polish. All of the sort of primary memes that people have seen are from that period. And I found that after that, there was really no stuff that was hilariously bad. Like, there was a few times, it's not really a spoiler, but like, you can imagine, like, it's Mass Effect. They're going to give you a spaceship at one point. And when I was looking at Ryder's face, at like her reaction to getting the spaceship, I had to shadow play it and send it to my friend because he was wondering on the other end of the house why he heard me belly laughing. Like, it's very strange. So yeah, though, they definitely take you out of the experience, because sometimes there's a scene that's like, say, you becoming a Spectre in Mass Effect 1, you know, getting the Normandy in Mass Effect 2, where they're meant to be really, you know, they kind of key points in the main character's arc. Sometimes it takes you out of them, but from what I've experienced past the first 8 hours, the frequency of that really decreases, which really makes you wonder why EA seemed to be like, yeah, you can see the worst bit of the game. And very strange.
That's really interesting. And a few people have said, and maybe we can get back to that, that also the missions are not the best ones, the ones they start you off with. The planet is not the most interesting. I think in your first impressions video, you mentioned it was basically Arizona, and that was basically one environment, and it was kind of crappy. Not that Arizona is crappy, although
That I've ever even been to Arizona.
I have. It's a desert, so if you like that kind of thing. But the beyond the fact that some people have been mentioning, you know, that the reason the animations look so bad is that the graphics, you know, the modeling of the characters is so much better that you get into that uncanny valley where when the animation isn't as good, then it stands out more. Honestly, looking back at the animations from Mass Effect 1, 2, or 3, it doesn't feel like that, honestly. It feels like the animations are, some of those animations are just bad. But beyond that, The way game development works usually is that you start working on your levels and on your, you know, different architecture from the middle of the game, and then you leave the end you're going to do towards the end of the development cycle, because you have had basically training and trials to do the best you can. But the very beginning, you do absolutely last, so that you're certain that players getting in get the best possible experience, and maybe they try out a little bit of it and are sold on the game. So it's a great first impression. Apparently they didn't do that, right?
They really don't seem to have done that. It's strange. It's a game that technically has went through a 5-year long development cycle. Usually that means years 1 and 2, and maybe even a little bit of 3, but probably just 1 and 2 are spent in the pre-production phase, which, I mean, to me, it would have assumed that they would have had a lot of their core kind of technical issues and questions answered during that period. You're definitely right. Like, the older models didn't look great. Like, sometimes Shepard pulled some mighty awkward-looking faces, even if it was supposed to be like a really heartfelt romance scene, and he's just derping out in the corner. But I suppose for a lot of people, they would have expected that there would have been an increase. Really what the Uncanny Valley thing is speaking to, and I remember I sent a good screenshot of the game to a friend of mine who is he's a rendering engineer over at Rare, the Sea of Thieves at the minute, but his first reaction to it was, wow, that subsurface scattering shader in the skin is great. It's like, you know, you've got this human skin, but it's not moving like most human skin that you're used to seeing. And then you get really freaked out. But as I said, after hour eight, it's a mixture of you get used to it and there's genuinely less big derp out, so it's okay. I just got to assume that they had some, you know, fun issues in game development, which I guess is pretty much always the case.
All right, so let's stop focusing on these very specific issues as my wife is coming home. So I tried to mute the mic, but I guess it was the little voice on Discord, the little sound is going to be heard on the recording. So apologies for that. Hey, honey. So what was I saying? Right, let's stop focusing on those memes and kind of that silliness, because the main question about the game is actually how good is it. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the feeling of adventure and discovery in that game, because they've made a little bit of a number of the fact that you're going to have a few you know, handcrafted planets to go explore that are going to be their own ecosystem. And you know, the what I was really looking for in that game was what I found in Mass Effect 1, which was I think a little bit lost in the subsequent titles, which is that feeling of exploring the galaxy. Like you're there, you're left to basically your own devices. And the game is telling you, go and find stuff out. Does that work in that game or not?
Yeah. Well, not as much as Mass Effect 1, in that 1 had, I think, a high number of not particularly detailed worlds. So this definitely goes for smaller worlds, but more detail. But it's definitely, in many ways, the game is closer to Mass Effect 1 than it would have been to 2 and 3. So that's down to, you've got more exploration. It's even down to the awkward and, you know, sort of front-heavy introduction to the game. In many ways, yeah, it does feel like it's a sequel to Mass Effect 1, not to Mass Effect 3, which I think for many people is probably a really good thing. Like, there have been times where, you know, I'm exploring a planet and it's genuinely cool. And it really helps that, you know, they're in Frostbite. They can pull off some really just beautiful-looking shots and vistas and, you know, environments and all that stuff.
Yeah, Frostbite is definitely an asset there if you want to get players to have a sense of wonder at the environment. All right, so overall, the gameplay, like the actual minute-to-minute gameplay, action gameplay is good. The exploration is there. Why do I get the feeling that from the reviews I've read, this is basically a good, probably photocopy of Mass Effect and not as good as the, you know, the original trilogy? Is that just my impression, or?
I think it's a game that's had an incredibly hard act to follow. As much as Mass Effect 3 had its issues, and I probably wouldn't rate it as highly in hindsight for a few things, not including the ending, but that game ended up for reviewers, and I think for, you know, almost everyone who played it, being the culmination of, what, 7 years of storytelling? So it's always going to be an uphill battle when they're trying to sort of do something new. I've seen a lot of people talk about maybe they don't connect with Ryder as much as Shepard, which I've initially, based on how I found Shepard in Mass Effect 1, I kind of prefer initial Ryder, and I think it's actually worth getting into that in a little bit. Oh dear, I've managed to lose my train of thought. What was the question?
It, like, is it a photocopy of Mass Effect? Like, does it live up to the expectations of the original trilogy, which are admittedly pretty high because of the emotional factor of it, but, you know, also can be considered in a more factual manner? Is it as good a game?
It's so hard to say that one objectively. I think there is a lot of excellent game in there, if you're looking for the right thing, I suppose. I'd imagine, like a lot of people, there's this
problem. So what's the right thing?
Right, it's tricky. So Dragon Age Inquisition is a good example of when I think the formula didn't work for a lot of people, where, as an example, the Hinterlands, I think that was an area that was renowned for being really big, really long, not that much high-quality content, yet the overall game, if you followed it in the right way, did have a really engaging story and good characters. So I feel like for a lot of players, if they go in and they know roughly what type of content to maybe gloss over, the more sort of MMO-like stuff, I think there is a really good, perhaps 30 to 50 hour long single player RPG that's got, you know, good characters, a good plot, even if it is a tad generic in places. I think there is a very good game in there. It didn't seem to be helped by the various memes, which catch on fire, as they always... Yeah, I think unfortunate circumstances have maybe marred it more than it should be, and it definitely is a game with quite a lot of flaws. If you like the Mass Effect universe, though, I think you'll be into it.
Mm. So maybe it's in that area where it can speak to the fans of the game franchise, genre, whatever, but maybe it's not good enough that it transcends that genre and can be recommended to any gamer who enjoys gaming, period. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think so. I think those people would probably want the context of the previous games. Because as an example, like as a Mass Effect player, you know what a Krogan and Turian is, so they don't really go to much length to introduce those races. It's just sort of assumed that you already know what they're like. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts on it are, because I'm correct, you enjoyed Mass Effect 1, but didn't really get into future ones?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And actually, the issue, one of the issues I have, it's interesting you mentioned the Krogans and everything, and is it feels weird that the races from a whole other different galaxy are basically the same. And I understand, you know, they go there just as we do, but do we get that feeling of differentness, like, you know, again, discovery, including from different alien races that we encounter, or do they suffer the issue of Star Trek, and I apologize to both Trekkies and Trekkers, of, you know, a new race is basically a new head thing on a regular person, and they're like, oh, that's a Blarg, and the Blargs are terrible, right? So is it...
Yeah, in fairness, they've got slightly more makeup on the new faces this time around for the new race.
But it's the same
thing. I think they are a fundamentally interesting concept as a race. Their story, though, is
but it's one race. It's like the what is it? I can't remember. It doesn't even matter. But
I mean, so far it's one. Mm. Well, not two, but yeah, I don't want to sort of get into more late game things. And I guess the final thing that I've found interesting is a lot of the critique for writers writing. And what was weird to me is I kind of was with some of the critiques there, and then I headed onto the wiki randomly for the character. Turns out she's 22, or he if you roll the male writer. There's a lot of people who are talking about this dialogue, which is kind of a little bit more goofy and awkward in some places. But to me, it feels like you're definitely playing a character who's 22, doesn't have much experience. Which I guess in a few ways I find relatable. If you were maybe used to Commander Shepard, who is a goddamn Commander Shepard, you know?
Right, right.
If you're used to this sort of hardened military person, it might be a bit strange, but I think that they've got a good opportunity to explore some new ground with their characterization, because overall it's a younger squad. They're a bit less experienced, and sometimes that can lead to some pretty good moments.
And so that is expressed in the writing and in the situations they put you in. It's because that sounds to me like good writing, if they manage to convey these kinds of things.
I think with writing, it's always a fine line, really, especially if you're trying to do a character who's approaching. And it mainly comes up in one or two of the romances, which, of course, have been clipped and uploaded to YouTube. there's a particularly great one where a character's response to the situation being awkward is just, kill me now. but yeah, I found some of that stuff endearing. I completely understand how much it wouldn't be for others, though. But it's not been a major problem for me. That said, there's one or two characters, like that Addison one, whose face is tired, as the internet.
Right, the one we've seen in most of the GIFs and memes,
Man, there's no defense for her. I have no idea what is going on there.
All right. Well, so, you know what? There is some criticism to be leveled at the game, it seems, but your thoughts got me to a more positive outlook on the game than I had before. So maybe at some point in the far-flung future of the, you know, future where I have time for other games, I might pick it up and check it out.
Yeah. If you were okay with the clunks of one and loved the some of the other elements, then I think it's got a good chance.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for those first impressions. That was Mass Effect Andromeda. Now let's talk a little bit about the Switch and the report from, it was I think even a week, 10 days ago, where one of the many analyst firms, it was Super Data, there you go, estimates that the game, the console has sold 1.5 million units in the world. And that was, as I said, maybe 10 days even more ago. So it's likely that they've sold more since then. And that's not the biggest surprise for the console, because we know it's been relatively successful. People are responding to the concept, etc., etc. But it leads us to a more interesting rumor. I don't know if we can call it a rumor, a report from the Wall Street Journal that says the manufacturing of the Switch has been doubled for the next fiscal year. So that's April 2017 to March 2018. It was 8 million that they ordered, and they doubled it to 16 million, which is a significant impact on the entire company. It seems like that is the best, if it's true, and you know, the Wall Street Journal is a reputable publication, so I would be inclined to believe them. But if it's true, it is the best confirmation possible that it is indeed a really good success for Nintendo beyond what we could have hoped. They are going to sell out those 2 million they were talking about in March. And they are planning on selling a lot more in the upcoming months and year. And that's a really positive thing for people who love, you know, Nintendo and gaming. I believe you're mostly a PC gamer, Michael, but you do have a Switch. I wonder what you think of it and what your, you know, opinion is on that report.
So I'm mostly a PC gamer, but I think if you are a PC gamer and you're going to have one console, it probably should be something Nintendo, because you're not going to get their catalog on your PC, and it's pretty damn unique. So I've got the Switch. I've put about 2 hours into Zelda, which is unfortunate, but I've got a train ride and a house with no computer for the next weekend. So I definitely plan to put a lot more into that. It's interesting with that increased production, especially looking at their launch lineup. I think it shows a lot of confidence from Nintendo in Mario and their other titles that are coming, which is... It's interesting to me because it's similar to what they did way back when they tried to save the Wii U, where there was a period of time where they just had all these games and they just kind of staggered them out. So they had all these games with a really high percentage of Wii U owners purchasing them. It seems like they've learned some good lessons from that, but are dealing with a way more successful bit of hardware.
Yeah, I mean, for the Wii U, the attach rate was huge. The attach rate being the number of games people buy for each console. I mean, the attach rate for... Actually, that might not be the right metric. The number of people owning the console buying one specific Nintendo game was really high, maybe only because there was no other games coming out. But yeah, it really does show a lot of confidence. I think the difference between the Wii U and the Switch is now the launch period being extremely successful for the Switch. And that basically kickstarting, it's what we've been talking about for months since they announced the thing. And we were, or I don't want to speak for everyone, at least I was saying they need to nail the launch period. If they don't, then it's going to be a problem going forward. But they did, and that's going to generate interest from developers. A lot of people are going to be looking at it. The saving grace, well, that might be a strong term, but the quality of Zelda is really what is giving the Switch its reactors, launching it into orbit. It's not done. Obviously, there's a lot of things that need to happen to make it a real success, but given they managed to do well on that launch period everything else unlocks. And they do have a few games that are coming out over the next few months, which now that people are responding positively to the console initially, just become additional reasons to be more positive. Whereas if things had been a little bit more nuanced in the beginning, people would have said, well, it doesn't really change my opinion. But since the opinion is already positive, I think that's a great sign. And also what you're saying, I actually didn't really think of it because I'm a very much a, you know, PC and console gamer. But if you own a PC and you want to buy a console, I don't think there's even a question, right? If you're a PC gamer,
yeah,
you need a Switch, not any of the other ones.
Yeah, bar Uncharted and The Last of Us, which will keep me of having course. Some money invested in Sony's side. But yeah, it seems like that is, it is the most unique sort of set of games, and it's the most un-PC sort of
yeah.
unpolitically correct Nintendo games. But yeah, it's not like your Counter-Strike or your League or your Dota or your WoW or your StarCraft.
Mm.
It's a completely different experience, so I think it's probably the best one. And it's
going portable.
To be interesting. Yeah, that too. I think that's genuinely a really, really good innovation. It's interesting seeing, because the Switch, on a hardware perspective, is essentially you're looking at an NVIDIA Shield tablet, but done in a really, really good and attractive package as far as the, you know, the whole Switch mechanic goes.
You know, go ahead.
Would you say Nintendo's best game in the last 10 years, or at least one of them?
Zelda?
Yeah.
One of them for sure. I absolutely adored Super Mario 3D World. I think it's one of the best design games ever created, including for Nintendo. That was a stellar game, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping it will come out on the Switch so I can buy it again and play it again. Like, that's how dumb I am about this whole thing. But yeah, Zelda, definitely. And we can talk about this a little bit more, actually. But you mentioned Uncharted, The Last of Us, which, yes, if you want to play those games specifically, although we're going to be talking about PlayStation Now in a little bit, and that might have a bearing on that. But if you want to play console, you know, manufacturer exclusive titles, yes, you're going to have to buy those consoles anyway. But I think if you have a powerful PC, you're playing PC games and you're a PC gamer, then if you want to have something that provides you with a different kind of experience, the Switch is going to be what does that, hopefully. And it provides you with another thing we've been talking about a lot on the show, which is a genuine gamer's experience in a portable way, which, let's be honest, phones and tablets do not provide. So yeah, that's a really interesting way of looking at it for avenues for people to buy the Switch.
By not competing with anybody, they've managed to just escape that entire thing, really. Because the Wii U tried to compete with the PS4 and the Xbox One, and it didn't have it just didn't. Whereas this is one of those times where it makes complete sense to have a PC and a Switch, to have a PS4 and a Switch. They don't have this limited market that's sort of caught in a console war. It's kind of universally applicable.
You know, it's really funny because we always say that's the, you know, 20-year-old analysis. Nintendo doesn't compete with the other console makers, or Nintendo does things differently. And it's always been true, but usually, I mean, it's been really hit and miss. Like, for the Wii, it was a success, but I don't think it was a success for gamers. It was a success for a party trick that you would put out, you know, a couple of times a year, and then it would go back in the cupboard. And for the Wii U, it completely flopped, and that was also something you could say, you know, oh, they're doing things differently. But here, the concept is what makes it work. It functions as a portable console. So that's absolutely, and it's exactly what you're saying. It's the same thing. They do things differently. They're not competing with the big guys in the industry, and they're carving their quote unquote niche, even if the niche is really large. But this time it's working because they're doing it with a clever product.
So, yeah. I'm fascinated to see what indies do with it.
Yeah, that's the, well, that's, again, another thing that they're doing pretty well is leveraging the indie's enthusiasm and market for the console in a way that maybe others have done, but not in the same way. I mean, the uniqueness of the product being portable is a huge opportunity for indie games. So again, there's a synergy there then that maybe wasn't as important for other consoles or even previous Nintendo consoles, and they're using this really well.
So the Ouya people must be just... Because if you think about it, you know, Ouya, its main game was Towerfall, and from what I know of Towerfall, it's, you know, party game, you sit down, you play with your friends. This is the literal perfect console for that. You just bring your Switch over, assuming you've got a few Joy-Cons. Now suddenly you and four or eight of your people can play like an indie, like a party brawler, or just that whole genre of games that in many ways, like, it's existed on PC, but it's never really been the right platform for them.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And there are a few other games that would, that might work like this. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to follow. And, you know, I was a little bit down on the Switch, and things progressed in a positive manner as months went by, and they kept announcing different things, and the price in Europe, or at least in France, came down to what I was, you know, hoping it would be. So that was overall a positive experience. But yeah, now I'm kind of really happy with the Switch, even though, again, I still don't recommend it for anyone, because the only game there's right now is Zelda, so I would say wait until the end of the year. But
which I guess comes back to those increased sales, increased manufacturing. I think they know that next winter rolls around, and I guess the following fiscal year as well, that's when there'll be such a large library of, if that Mario can live up to 3D World or something, then yeah, that's good. It's going to be a good quarter for them, I suppose.
So I think if Mario can live up to the high expectations that we have for every Mario game, and that games like 3D World and Zelda set, if it's as good as Zelda, basically there's going to be no need for any other game on the console ever. Everyone should own one anyway. Right? But I mean, I'm overdoing it a little bit, obviously. But I think they're going to sell a lot of them, because they finally made, I think, the perfect second gaming device. And there's a lot of gamers that want a second gaming device, enough of them to make that console a success. And all of the other ones, even if the Wii, again, was successful, I'm talking about from a gamer's perspective, and we could debate that for a long time. Finally, they have managed to create an actual second console that works really well for any gamer. So,
yeah, now that I think about it, I think the first people to have this idea were Razer.
Oh, there's been a few different attempts,
Was it CES 2010? They had the tablet with, I think, Windows 8.1. They were raving that it could play Battlefield 3 on these two controllers bolted onto the side at 30 frames a second.
Well, you know, I can't remember if it was Razer or Nvidia that had the idea first. Maybe it was Razer. You're right. Really interesting company, by the way, Razer.
It's nice to see that they're trying new ideas. You know, that said, I don't use their keyboards anymore, but. Yeah, some cool ideas coming from them.
Yeah, I have a Razer keyboard and mouse, a couple of mice actually. But yeah, they're trying really interesting things. I think in a slightly clumsy way, they have the PC master race ethos, which I think holds them back a little bit in some of their endeavors, like the silly concept laptop with three screens. I mean, it's funny, but come on. And a lot of what they do has that kind of spirit into it.
Gul'dan from World of Warcraft would absolutely
be, what do you want? Everything. But they also have some interesting stuff. Some of their laptops are really good. So that's Razer. Yeah. But I think it's kind of the same moment when the iPhone or the iPad came out. You know, it's like these kinds of ideas have been done before, but never executed in a way that made sense from a user perspective. And Nintendo has managed to create, you're right, it's kind of the same thing as that Razer concept or the Nvidia Shield, except the small changes make the concept work. So it's really important. Those what might seem like small changes are really important if you want to have a successful product.
Yeah, doing something new and doing it so good that you suddenly have a monopoly.
Yeah, exactly. and so the other element of that puzzle is Zelda, and I just want to talk very quickly again about it to mention one story that's been making the rounds. Jim Sterling review. He's a YouTuber.
Yes.
Which, I mean, he's not my cup of tea. He kind of rides the controversy wave more often than not, but he's also very straightforward and forceful and honest. But I mean, he's not my kind of reviewer, the person I would go to, but still, he's someone I would consider a genuine gamer who cares about games. And he gave a review that was 7 out of 10 for Zelda, and that launched into some idiotic, like some people were trying to DDoS him to get his site down. Not trying, they actually did it,
yeah.
Which is the height of idiocy. But I think overall it's kind of a non-story, so I hesitated even talking about it. But what I did want to say was, of course he can have his opinion. Of course some people are not going to like the game. It's almost universally praised, but you're going to have, not everyone is going to be of the same opinion about everything. So yeah, some people are not going to enjoy Zelda all that much. Although, you know, 7 out of 10 is not a bad ranking for a game. What I didn't love was the fact that he was mentioning things like, oh, they have towers just like in Assassin's Creed. Like getting hung up on the fact there are towers in the game where the towers are fulfilling a completely different role from a game design standpoint. Not completely different, but significantly different than they do in the other games. And, you know, it's like saying, oh, that game has swords just like Dark Souls, and I don't like Dark Souls, so I don't like this other game. Which I thought that was a little bit, clumsy. But beyond that, I mean, if he doesn't like the game, it's fine.
I think it's one of those things that seems to, like, pervade politics and the whole spectrum of things where normally we can agree on the facts, I suppose. But then it's just
everyone
comes...
say we can agree on the facts, and now it's not really that world
anymore. I just realized that that's not really how it works these days. But yeah, we mostly agree on the facts, just come to slightly different conclusions. But yeah, sometimes it seems like there's a group of people, and it's just unfortunately a bit, it seems to them like it's incomprehensible that somebody might have a different opinion, which is, yeah. I don't really know how we're going to get sidestep that one. Like with Jim's, I agreed with most of what he said, but I just wouldn't have weighted them as negatively, but he's right to have his opinion. Plus there's a certain morbid curiosity in the things that go on with Jim Sterling.
Yeah.
Every now and then, he seems to attract fun times.
Well, that's something he cultivates as well. I think it's the core of his success. I think is that weird. Anyway, we don't even need to talk about it all that much. I just wanted to mention it because yes, people are going to have different opinions about things, and that's okay. So you know, we don't have to always be in that sense of I think. Something and I need to convince people that is the right way to think. And that was an example of that. And there's a lot of it in gaming. So,
but Patrick, your think is wrong think. How dare you?
You know, that's funny because usually it's the other people who think other things that are wrong. So that's, I'm not used to that me being wrong thing. It's very confusing. Of additional things on Zelda, there are two videos which I would like to recommend if you still haven't had enough of Zelda and you know, conversation and analysis and discussion about why Zelda is so interesting. One of them is the Breaking Conventions with the Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild video, which is basically a panel from Nintendo that they made at GDC a little bit before the game was released, and is available in video form. And it's amazing. Like, the one thing I will mention is how there was one thing about the physics engine I couldn't put my finger on, which was making it so wonderful. And they talk on that panel about the fact that they went with a physics engine, which is really important, but part of it, they separated both, but it's really part of it was a chemistry engine. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but that really makes it magical. Like the way different elements interact with one another and the way some of the chemistry elements can transform the state of other elements, be them chemistry elements or physical elements. And that is fascinating. It put all of this physics engine magic in focus and explained why it was working so well in the game and why it felt so such an important part of the experience. So I would really encourage anyone interested in this and going to check it out.
It's definitely one of the most joyous things when a developer is able to use one or two small systems to, when you probably look into the code and the interaction, it's probably really quite simple, but it's definitely done that the number of different scenarios and feelings and gameplay that that tiny thing can create just balloons. Almost like the Nemesis system in Shadow of Mordor, or whenever it's systems, but really done brilliantly like that.
Well, it's funny you're saying this because that's exactly what they're talking about. They're saying they're not a huge team, so they had to focus on systems that would fill the world sort of by themselves and through the actions and creativity of the players. And the way they coined a term called multiplicative gameplay. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Basically, a few elements of gameplay and letting them balloon into more than what the individual parts are. And it really works in this game. So
I need to send that talk to the rest of the team.
I think, you know, I've been joking that basically every game developer right now is playing The Legend of Zelda and taking notes. I really think that's the case. And that kind of explains a lot of it. And they even say by the end of it, you know, we hope that this game will inspire you to do your own things that are going to be amazing. And, you know, it's like that magic of GDC, which is absolutely wonderful for gamers like us. But they talk about a bunch of other things in the talk. I really encourage you guys to go and check it out.
Yeah, like we're doing a game with Kaiju in it. So one of our, following a sort of a similar idea, this sort of food chain system is what we've been trying to cultivate. So all the different Kaiju have their own interactions between each other. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, evolution or something. You can just sort of set it up and it kind of runs itself.
Mm, yeah. It seems like something that would, you know, well, go check it out. You go watch the video. Mm. I think you'll get something out of it.
Absolutely.
And the other one is a little bit shorter, but it's it gives me the opportunity to talk about a channel I really love called, it's Mark Brown's channel. His series is Game Maker's Toolkit. And he goes over why he thinks that Zelda is the resounding success that he thinks it is. It's just, you know, Legend of Zelda, an open world adventure. I'm going to link that video in the show notes. Go check that out as well. But basically, it summarizes my feelings for the game, which is it's just adventure. It's not about creating a game or gaminess. It's about putting the player in an adventure, and that's what it achieves. And he details why and how it works. And his whole channel is wonderful, but that video is especially interesting for today's, well, for Zelda. So,
yeah, I can't recommend his entire channel enough. It is one of the best bits of content on the internet. I'd say it's brilliant. Yeah.
Agreed. All right, a few other tidbits on the Sony side. Horizon Zero Dawn has had very significant sales, basically 2.6 million units in under 2 weeks. That's, if I'm not mistaken, the best launch numbers for a new franchise from Sony. And 2.6 million is huge. We knew that, you know, Zelda was doing well, and we weren't sure exactly how well Horizon Zero Dawn was doing. But when you have 50 million consoles in the wild, I guess that's an installed base that is going to give you good numbers if you do a good game. So we don't know exactly how many Zeldas have been sold. We know there are over 1.5 million consoles sold for the Switch. But as I failed on Twitter, there I forgot to remember that there are also Wii U versions of the game. So even if, you know, every Switch has sold one unit of Zelda, then there might be also Wii U versions, and we don't know exactly which one did better, which honestly doesn't really matter. What matters is Horizon Zero Dawn is doing really well, and I might pick it up as well after I'm done with Zelda, which I don't know when that will be. But so yeah, that's good news for that game.
That's really amazed me, because even thinking about, as an example, I think the 2013 Tomb Raider sold 6 million copies in however many months, and that was considered a really, you know, big failure for this multi-platform game. And then we see this just come in and completely, I don't know if dominate is the right word, but that's really, I was stunned when I saw that number.
Yeah, it is, you know, and I mean, the context is different as well for Tomb Raider, because there is, you know, it's a franchise, it has a history, and I think originally they were disappointed with the sales for the launch window, but then over the months it became a little bit more popular, and people were the sale numbers were more satisfactory, which is why they launched into the, you know, the sequels and et cetera. But yeah, for Horizon, maybe we don't even need to really get into it. But another reason I'm happy about that is the yet another proof that, you know, you can have a strong female lead. And not only does it sell well, but that doesn't even really matter. Beyond a few really angry people, it doesn't matter anymore that we have a female lead. Whereas I think a few years ago, it might have been a big deal. Now it was mentioned at E3, and now it's almost not a topic of conversation, which is awesome. So
yeah, it was funny going back like Mass Effect 3 and seeing its marketing before the FemShep trailer came out. And I was like, who's this? it's nice that that's a non-issue, because like even when it was a debate, it's a pretty boring one, and there's like the market, not to take an overly sort of free market perspective on it, but it's nice that the market has proven that it obviously does work. The hope is like there'll be a few executives who maybe, it's one of those things. I remember talking to, I was at a conference, Barry Mead was talking at it. He's the guy at The Room, it's like the series of iPad games. But he went on this, it was a glorious 20-minute long rant full of just like, the swears per minute was great. He was really getting into it. But about how, the numbers follow the previous numbers. You need to do something new to sort of create new trends. And that's one of, you know, the weaker parts of some of the publisher world is like, well, this thing previously worked with a male protagonist, so we don't want to deviate from that. When really it seems like there was only poor numbers for games like that because they just hadn't been tried properly, or they didn't have the requisite like funds put behind them.
Yeah. Well, I think we're seeing the results of that realization a couple of years ago that, oh, well, we're doing this and we could be trying that. And now they're trying that. And because for a number of reasons, it's the right thing to do, and et cetera, et cetera. And anyway, I didn't want to be launched into it, but I did want to mention it. Lastly, the PlayStation Now is going to include PlayStation 4 games going forward. I think it starts in, what is it, in a couple of months. And it's only available on PlayStation 4 and PC, and that's where it gets to you, Michael, because we get... it also seems the price has dropped a little bit. It's $100 a year or $20 a month. And the yearly amount, if you have some of the Sony exclusive games, I feel could be interesting to a PC gamer. I mean, if we start getting, which we don't yet, but if we start getting, you know, the latest Uncharted and The Last of Us, and maybe they're not going to put it in the service, but that might do the trick for you.
Yeah, at the end of the day, Sony fund, as much as, you know, you get the odd Beyond Two Souls or something, but they do fund some of the best games. Just flat out the best games, like as much as PC Gamer, WoW YouTube channel, you know, all that. My favorite game of that whole sort of last console generation was The Last of Us.
Ah, a man after my own heart.
Yeah, so that's why I have a PS3 for that one. Certainly, I think it will be pretty big for PC. The only thing that would hold me back slightly is It's weird. I can't see myself in my office chair playing Uncharted. But with Steam in-home streaming and all of that, there are ways around that. I think one of the trickier things to deal with PlayStation now and a lot of those streaming services is lag. That said, a lot of the games like Uncharted 4, you know, like I love my frame rates. Got 100 hertz monitor, it's buttery smooth. But for whatever reason, when I was playing Uncharted 4, I didn't really care because I've never experienced a better 30 frames per second in my life. Just the frame timings being solid, it never deviates. So, you know, technically impressive. If they can find a way to just have the streaming quality really allow the same gameplay to exist, I think it will be very big. And I think Sony clearly know there's a group they're not going to convert, but that really want to play their exclusive games because they're brilliant.
It's all going to be the library, how good it is. But it's also, I think, really interesting to see Sony prepare for the possibility that this is going to be the way people, or some people, consume games in the future, basically creating a Netflix of gaming. And if they manage to, I mean, they do need some of the third-party developers to be on board, but they also have a library of games that is, or the franchises that is good enough. And it feels like, I know some people might call me a little bit biased, but I really don't think so. I think it's true that they're developing more, you know, interesting sequels and different franchises and new properties on their platform than Microsoft is, especially in the past year or two. Maybe it's going to change with the Scorpio coming out, you know, this year, hopefully. But yeah, it feels like Sony is better prepared for, or preparing better for, the potential future than Microsoft might be. But I don't know.
Yeah, Microsoft, I think they've tried to lean quite heavily in Halo and then maybe didn't have as much of a success with Halo 5 as they wanted, whereas Sony's just continually pumped out really good quality stuff. I know that, like, they've, from what I sort of hear from a few interviews and stuff, Sony are pretty, they allow for quite a lot of creative freedom. I know from the Guerrilla Games guys, they were pretty much allowed, behind Horizon Zero Dawn, they're pretty much allowed to do whatever they want, which is really nice to see from them, because Killzone, it wasn't the most unique thing ever. It was definitely cool.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, it was really nice seeing them do something that feels like a really creatively interesting piece of work.
Yeah. And finally, the PlayStation 3 is nearing its end of life. The production is going to be winding down in the next couple of months. And it's been 10 years since the console launched. It launched in Japan in November 2006 and in March 2007, I believe, in EU and the US maybe. But yeah, so it's been 10 years, a good long life. And I think if anything is to be remembered from the PlayStation 3, is that it's that you can have an absolutely disastrous, horrendous start and still manage to get a successful console ultimately if you put your muscles behind it. So
Really killed it towards the end. I'd say the other thing to learn from that is don't piss off all the programmers. As much as the cell architecture was really powerful, it doesn't seem like it made a lot of the coders happy.
Yeah, definitely. It was a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the price at launch, and like it, that was a mess. The early couple of years of PlayStation 3 were terrible.
So yeah, it seemed messy.
Anyway, but you were like what, 5 when it launched? No, 12. Did you even remember the PlayStation 3 launch?
I remember third year maths class. I was like, 14 or something, debating which one was the best with a friend of mine. I was in camp PS3 because I was like, but it's really powerful. He was like, no, Xbox. And well, I bought an Xbox and played Halo for my earlier years. And
as most people did. Yeah, I got an. Yeah. I was Team Xbox 360 back in the day when it first started. It was ridiculous. The PlayStation was, and they were like, yeah, the cell, and which was it? The Emotion Engine? Maybe that was PlayStation 2.
I think that was 2.
Yeah.
But part of why the 3 was so expensive is it basically had a PS2 bolted on inside of it.
On top of it, yeah. All right. Well, I guess that's going to be it for the show. I want to thank you very deeply for being on the show. It was a real pleasure for me personally because, as I said, I love what you do. And if other, you know, if listeners want to find out what you do, they have been intrigued by our conversation, where would they go?
They could go to youtube.com/bellyeatergaming. So that's where all the World of Warcraft content goes. There's my Twitter handle, which is, I suppose, the best place to get me, just at bellyeatergaming. And World of Warcraft videos and stuff aside, I'd encourage people to look out for the World of Warcraft add-on that we're making. We want to redo the narrative. We're doing a whole bunch of voice acting. It should be pretty cool, and it should be out within the month, assuming no insane disasters.
Wow, already? That's going to be a really quick turnaround. You started, what, in January?
Yeah, we started in January. We there's this mod called Console Port, which I don't use it that much, but I thought it was just a really well put together thing. So I ended up getting to know that developer, and we've been working with him for some of the tech stuff. And
cool.
Thomas does his theater writing, so we've got the script going, and yeah, it's been good fun. That said, it's only a zone at a time. We haven't done the entire of Azeroth in 3 months.
Just to explain to people what it is, very quickly, you're basically redoing Elwynn Forest, which is basically the starter zone for humans in the game, and you're redoing that from a narrative standpoint, the quest chains there, and so you're basically going to be able to have a new adventure in Elwynn Forest, right?
Yeah, it was amazing with Elwynn. Like, it would be bizarre, I think, to anyone who's played it since Cataclysm. The entire zone is actually a conspiracy about the Devious Brotherhood, Vanessa Van Cleef, and this guy called the Collector. But you would never know that from playing it, because you have to read quest text and wikis. So really our goal was for the zones like Elwynn that feel sparse to really bring out the narrative that is there. And then for zones like, say, Westfall, which have a really good directed story, the goal is just to kind of, you know, live up to that and provide an experience that feels maybe a bit closer to what people would be used to with Legion.
Cool. Well, we'll be looking forward to that.
Thank you for having me as well. It's nice, you know, 10 years after
Let's not dwell on that even more than I have. Maybe I did a little bit too much for my own sanity. But yeah, so for me, it's not Patrick on Twitter and Facebook. And you can find this show at frenchspin.com. And you can also leave us a review on iTunes, for example, just like Yeshi did from the US. They said, great show, 5 stars. It's a great show. Just make sure you keep politics out of it. Let's stick to games. Well, we didn't really talk about politics all that much. If you do like politics, there's another show you can listen to. It's called The Phileas Club, and it's also available on frenchspin.com. And on that show, we get people from different cultures, different parts of the world, to tell us about what's been happening in their corner of the planet, and maybe tell us what they think about what's been happening in other parts of the planet. So you get perspective, conversations, respectful all the time, you know, being able to listen to people, and that's really important, I feel. So hopefully, Yeshi, you get something out of it if you go and check out that show as well. And we'll keep talking about games on this one, and we'll do that next time in a couple of weeks. I hope you join us for that. And again, Michael, thank you very much for being here and for finally finding your way to me after 10 years.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you for having me.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.